When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, everybody. Today's guest is singer, songwriter, and pianist Howard Jones from Southampton, England. Together, we take a deep dive into the writing, recording, and inspiration behind his 1983 breakout hit single, New Song, taken from his debut album, Humans Live. A little interesting tidbit, New Song is the first track ever dissected here on Krista Makes a Podcast to not feature any traditional instruments, such as the electric guitar. Howard was on the cutting edge of this then new technology, and he embraced it tenfold. He really was a pioneer of the new wave scene, and the blueprint he had a part in creating is still heard in today's modern dance and pop music. Howard mentioned that he always strives for a connection between the listener and what he's trying to convey with his lyrics. These weren't corny teeny bopper lyrics. They had substance, which is one of many reasons why Howard's music still resonates with his fans after all these years. And speaking of years, it's been 40 years since New Song was released, and I was impressed that my analysis brought up a lot of great memories about the song for Howard. So sit back, relax, and throw off your mental chains. This is a good one.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard?
Podcast. Howard, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Chris.
This is a real treat for me. I got to tell you, when I saw the press release come through from your publicist, I just don't know where 40 years have went since the release of New Song, your first single, but congratulations.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much.
It's amazing. And I was talking to my producer before we got rolling here, Howard, and I think we're up to whatever it is now, 160 episodes or something. We've been at this for about 3 years.
Amazing.
I think this is the first song that we've ever had in the show that doesn't have any guitars or actual, you know, instruments that rock bands would use, totally electronica, except for your voice. And that is really, really cool to me. And it's also, I recall, and I know you heard this a lot. I remember, you know, when a lot of the new wave stuff was happening, when you were first coming up, it's the critics, oh, you know, they're just pushing buttons. This isn't real. And as I'm listening to this song, I'm like, well, he still had to come up with all the melodies. He had to figure out which buttons to push that were right. So it's just fascinating to me that after all this is the first song. I do believe there isn't real instruments. Is that correct?
I just think with on the Rupert Hine version, I used the studio piano, which was a highly doctored piano. But the original single, no, doesn't have any, I would call it conventional instruments rather than real.
Okay.
I think that, I always say that, a piano keyboard is a series of switches, right?
Yeah.
That are touch sensitive. And that somebody can come in and play a piano and make you want to run as far as you can to the hills. And then another person sets down and plays and presses those switches and makes you want to cry. So, you know, and it's exactly the same with, you know, any instrument. It's like, it's the way you do it.
I'm going to use your descriptor, conventional. Yeah, it's conventional, not real, conventional. That's the better term. And you just mentioned something interesting. You said the Rupert Hine version. Rupert Hine, of course, produced your debut album, Humans Lib. New Song, however, was released on August 19th of 83. The album didn't come out till March 5th of 84. And the original version was produced by Colin Thurston. Yeah. So the album version, that was still the Colin Thurston one, correct?
Yes. I actually wanted to put Rupert's version on because I liked it better. But because New Song had been such a massive hit everywhere, that it was good sense to actually put that version on. But yeah, I mean, you know, Colin, you know, we started off recording it in the studio with Colin and got quite a long way with it, but it still wasn't right. And record company agreed with that. So we then took it to another studio. I think it was the place where David Bowie used to do his stuff in London. And we worked on drum machine parts and bass lines again, and then mixed it again. So it was quite a process getting it right. And then of course the record company, you know, as people do at those times, they didn't think the tempo was quite right, so they wanted to speed it up. And so, you know, now when I listen back to it, and then when people are trying to copy it at home, they'll find it's somewhere between, you know, C and C sharp. So it's a quarter of a tone, you know, up. But that was that was what was going on in the day. And this was my first single, and I had no experience of anything at all, you know, apart from writing and playing live and. But, you know, this was the first proper record I'd made. So, you know, my confidence was developing after that.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned that because I had to tune my guitar like three times. I'm wondering what's going on. I'm like, okay, wait a second.
It's not...
There was synths here. So, and you know, a lot of times too, as you know, you would pitch just stuff in the studio to make it sound a little warbly or off.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Chris, you're absolutely right. It was, but they just basically sped up the tape. It was, and it was recorded onto tape, analog tape. And there was no, you know, no digital recording at all. And
right,
actually, all the parts, apart from the drum machine and the sequence, you know, the everything else was played. So it wasn't like making a modern electronic record where
right
you can line up all the waveforms and get everything bang on. I played the bass part. I played all the other keyboard parts in live. So. It was a kind of hybrid record in a way. So, you know, using the synths, but actually it was mostly played.
I'm really glad you mentioned that too, because you don't really take that into consideration on the analog records, especially stuff that you were doing, like the dance and the pop and the new wave stuff. You know, it had to be on. So to your point, you had to play it again if it was rubbing anywhere, whereas today you just would scoot it around in Pro Tools.
That's right. I mean, you know, I think it's what gives the song its character musically, is that it's not... you know, sample accurate as we, you know, I make the records I make now, the electronic ones, you know, I can, as you're saying, I can line everything up, even though it may be played in initially and improvised initially, you can just get it, you know, absolutely perfected, which can be good sometimes, but not always appropriate. But New Song was definitely a kind of hybrid. Obviously the drum machines are locked in, the sequence is locked in, but everything else sort of is rubbery around that, which it would be more like, you know, a conventional band. Yeah.
What was it about the technology in the late 70s, early 80s to you that was fascinating? What drew you to it? Why did you embrace it?
Well, I played the piano since I was seven, and I loved anything with keys. On Saturday mornings when I was like 12 years old or something like that, there was a local organ shop, and they have Hammond organs in there, which, you know, was like a dream for me to have a Hammond organ.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was such a huge fan of Keith Emerson, and but they were really expensive. But the kind guys in that shop, they you know, it's quite a formal shop. You know, organ shops weren't like, you know, like rock and roll shops. They were, you know, people wore suits and ties and stuff. But they let me play, you know, the Hammonds and, you know, through the Leslie. So I was just, anything that had keys, I was just interested in. So at the point, and I'd been to music college up in Manchester, you know, studied piano for 2.5 years, but I was writing music and playing in bands that whole time as well. So I came back to live with my parents, actually, in, you know, in High Wycombe. And, you know, there wasn't anybody that around that I could form a band with. So I thought, I came up with, somebody lent me a drum machine. That's what happened. And so I was at the piano playing along with the drum machine. And I thought, I could develop this. If I got some of these new keyboards that were just coming out, I could turn this into a one-man electronic band. And that's where it got really exciting for me, because I had lots of keyboards to play and drum machines to run, sequences to run. And it was such a buzz to actually perform like that.
Yeah, and you don't have to deal with band members you don't like or have to pay them.
Yeah, I know, but that wasn't the driving force, Chris. I mean, that's so funny. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Musicians Union wanted to ban me for those kind of reasons. I've ended up employing more people than, you know, than a small factory, you know, over the years. Maybe not always. It would be technicians, it would be lighting guys, it would be band members, you know, so... Yeah, but I can't believe they literally wanted to kick me out of the Musicians Union because they thought I was robbing people of their jobs.
That is so funny. I mean, that's kind of what I was saying at the top, you know, like back then you had the critics like, oh, this, you know, they're just pushing buttons. This isn't real music. And here you are getting grief from those people too.
Yeah. I mean, I had to fight against that all the time, Chris. It was really, it was painful for me because it's like, I thought, I can look back on it now and realize exactly why that happened. And it's because when you try and do something new that isn't in the flow of what's gone before, you're going to take some flack, you know, and I did, you know, you put your neck above the parapet and you get fired. That's exact. And I was an easy target for that. Right.
Sure.
And Queen putting on their album, no synthesizers were used. It's like synthesizers are gonna, you know, make you a hit record, mate. No, they're not. I can tell you.
Right. Right. Yeah, they didn't use synthesizers, but they had 380 vocal tracks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan, but I was dismayed when I saw that, because it's like these are highly educated young men.
Right.
You know, and they don't get it. You know, what hope do we have for the future?
Well, I'll tell you about the hope for the future. If you go back to 83 when you recorded this and you look at stuff that's happening now, I hear stuff that sounds like this now, 40 years later. You know, everything comes in cycles, and it gives me a bit of a chuckle. You know, you had said a little bit ago, this was your first record. You were a little bit green and here you are. I have to ask, did you get any pushback from the label, record label at that time, regarding the name of your debut song, new song, because it's not in the chorus, it's not in the hook at all, and labels were really about that back then.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, does it? Calling a song new song.
Well, maybe not your debut single when you're an unknown.
I mean, there's green and then there's extreme green, you know. I mean, people going into the record shop and saying, oh, can I have a Howard Jones new song? Or, yeah, it's a song.
What's called it called?
New song. I can't remember the artist. It's called New Song. Like, I bought, you know, if you wanted to put some barricades in front of people to stop them buying your record, that's the way to do it. But, you know, it goes back to those early days when I was doing the one-man show in tiny pubs and clubs where they didn't normally have music at all. We used to, you know, make our own gigs up. And there was something about this one that I called it New Song, and I remember playing it for the first time in front of my, you know, my fans, who were just amazing in those days. They used to follow me everywhere. And playing it for them for the first time, and they went completely crazy. I ended up playing it 3 or 4 times that night. I know normally you don't do that, but I was so excited about the song as well. And I thought, oh, this is the one, this is the new song, you know, this is the way forward for me. And so that's why I honestly didn't think about it too much. Now I think it must be crazy. You should have called it Don't Crack Up, or, you know,
right,
bend your brain, see both. And there was a million titles in there you could have used.
Now, of course, back then with labels, you'd get like weekly or bi-weekly reports from the label. And I imagine it started to trickle in. Hey, you're getting played in the United States. You're getting played in other countries. What was that like? You know, here's this kid from Great Britain, and all of a sudden you're hearing you're getting played in American radio, which I heard you in 83, 84 on American radio.
I mean, it was incredible. It was incredible. And nobody knew anything about me, but they just really liked the song. And, you know, I know we've talked about it being, you know, made with electronic instruments, but it definitely had reference, didn't it, to eras gone by. You know, mm-hmm. It's like the organ sound, even the, you know, the riff is based on sort of a, you know, a classical motif, really. And then, you know, the sort of quite soulful vocals, as soulful as I could be. And yet it felt new. And then there's the, you know, the positive lyric side of it that we haven't talked about yet. So I think all those things added up to it really taking off. Mind you, you know, in the UK, it took 8 weeks to get to number three. It just crept up the charts. We were going to lose it at any moment. But it wasn't like a smash into the top 10 or anything.
Well, and remember too, you know, and I didn't know this till I started touring England back in the 90s, okay, when my band was starting to come over there, and we would go to these after parties, discos, they call them there, and we would hear our songs in there. And we're like a hard rock band and people are dancing to it. You know, we're a punk band. And I'm like, what is going on? It's just part of the culture. I imagine during this time you were out at the bars and the pubs and the clubs and you're hearing the song, which a lot of times the song can become a hit on the club level and never even reach radio.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, we were at the start of that time when, you know, as well as doing the 7-inch mix for radio, we immediately did the 12-inch.
Yeah,
version, you know, to go on vinyl out to the clubs, and it would be an extended version, and we'd have such, that was the most fun doing that, you know, doing the mixes.
Yeah,
and then hearing that in the club, which you know you EQ differently and you cut it differently for the vinyl and everything like that, so it was a real blast hearing it in clubs, so loud and great. Yeah,
I bet it was. Well, I want to jump into the song and the arrangement on this. You know, I never really realized arrangements of songs until I put them on paper in front of me. And it never would have dawned on me that this song was a little strange arrangement wise, but it is where the parts come in, but it works absolutely seamlessly. The song is 4:16, and we get these drum pads and they're kind of ping ponging right and left in the mix that start it. And that happens two times, followed by a kick drum that joins those drum pad hits. I hear a triangle in there and a main synth hook of the song for four bars. Was that like a triangle sound that was on one of the synths?
That'd be drum machine. Yeah. We started off with the drum machine pattern that I used live, and then we replaced some of the sounds using the AMS, you know, single hit sampler that was just very new technology at the time.
And again, you had to play that analog. You had to press it with your fingers, yes, or however
exactly.
You were doing it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Which, gosh, I mean, I could talk about this forever, but I mean, it had to drive you crazy at points. Some stuff wouldn't line up, or you just couldn't get it to work. You know, nowadays it's a push of a button. You can see it on the grid, but yeah. I imagine that was a process at times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was always syncing stuff up to, you know, drum machine clicks, and it would be it wasn't a very scientific process. But when I pull the song into Pro Tools now, I mean, the tempo is varying all over the place because the drum machines and the tape machines, you know, were slightly out with each other, and we used synth decode, didn't we, to, you know, to drive things.
Yeah.
And that would be not always completely accurate, and stuff wouldn't read it properly, and Yeah, but you know, it gives it its charm, doesn't it? Really,
you know? it absolutely does. I think that that's the beauty of this. Is yes, you were working with synthesizers and things, but you were still playing them. There was still the human factor.
You know,
you can really suck the life out of it when you put everything on a grid in Pro Tools and fix everything.
That's true.
Verse one is a double verse. I've been waiting for so long to come here now and sing this song. Oh, don't be fooled by what you see. Don't be fooled by what you hear. Whoa.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. This is an autobiographical first verse, really, you know. So I've been waiting for so long because I was playing the piano since I was 7. I was in bands at 14. I played the piano for 4 hours a day and put this one man show together. I couldn't get signed, you know. Nobody wanted to sign me until one label did in the end, and then they all wanted it, but you know, no publisher, and I had been waiting a long time. I was 28 when I got signed, you know. It was just like past it for a pop star, really, isn't it? And so
real quick, Howard, yeah. Back then that was old. Yeah. What I'd give to be 28 again.
Yeah exactly. So I've been waiting for so long to come in and sing. So that's totally, you know, I've been waiting for a long time to get to this place. And this was always my goal, to be making records and releasing them. Don't be fooled by what you know. That really, I think that's to do with, like, I'm making music with different instruments to what you may be used to. So you know, give it a bit of wide berth here. You know, it's like, it's a reference to the instrumentation I'm using and the way I'm making records, but also to in a wider political sense. You know, you got to question everything that you hear. Don't just believe everything that comes to you through the radio or the TV or print. You know, we really need to question things and come up with our own view of it, you know, and that's very much what those last two lines are.
I absolutely love this. You were dreaming. You were a kid. You were dreaming about getting your music out there and all the things that we've been talking about, you know, the electronic elements and non-traditional instruments. You're addressing that in the lyrics. That is so humble and cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't want to write traditional songs. You know, I wanted to write songs that would provoke thought in people, even though, you know, I'm using a pop genre here.
Right.
It's all about that. Like, the lyrics have always been the most important thing to me. That what you say, you know, you've got this incredible invitation into somebody's head. Because music, I mean, you know, you can't even see it. It just goes in there and it's in your head. So make sure that if you're in somebody's head, you say something that's meaningful to them.
That is awesome. I've never heard that before. Mm. And that is really cool. It's kind of like you're saying they're letting me in their headspace. Yeah. I might as well give them something to chew on. That's great. Well, this first half of verse one, a kick drum comes in. The main synth hook is there. There is a what sounds like delayed wood blocks. Again, I'm assuming that was on the drum machine. And that swooshing sound, I'm calling it almost like a roulette wheel with delay. Is that another synth sound? It's so cool.
No, Steve Taylor did that in one of his machines. I can't remember what he did, but he was it one of those? Yeah, no, it was one of those. You know, those tree what they call them, cymbal tree things. It's got all little cymbals all lined up, and you.
Oh, okay. I know what you're talking about.
It's got a name, isn't it? A proper name. And then
he
put it through a processor to make it go, you know, detuned, and yeah, it's a cool sound.
That is so awesome because, again, you know, these sounds that we have at our disposal now, I'm staring at a keyboard that has thousands of sounds. A lot of them you had to create back then.
Yeah.
They weren't invented yet. You heard something in your head and you're like, hey, can we create this? Hey, I'm going to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the keyboards, I mean, MIDI was just coming out. So That's how primitive it was then. So, yeah, but still plenty of choice, though.
Right. Well, this first half of verse one, those triangle hits are at the top of the first and third lines here. And then in between the first half of verse one and the second half, there is a two-measure instrumental with sporadic shaker sounds and drum machine hand claps before we get into the second half of the verse. And that part in and of itself is interesting, that you gave it a rest there for two measures. You backed off, some instrumentation came in, and you came back for the second part of the verse. Did you do a demo of this song?
Yeah, yeah.
You did?
This is where I did it live. I'm pretty sure I did anyway. Now, although Rupert was so good with arrangements, I think it was Rupert's idea that we reveal that main synth hook in stages. You know, the first time you just get it in C, it doesn't go to the minor. And you just get a teaser and then get straight on with this, you know, the second, well, the third verse, isn't it?
Yeah. Right, exactly. This is a song to all my friends. They take the challenge to their hearts. Challenging preconceived ideas. Saying goodbye to long-standing fears.
Yeah, so, you know, I was very, very close to my fans. They helped me so much in those early days. I mean, it was a group of maybe 100, 150 people. And they would come with me everywhere I played, and we used to organize coaches for people to do that, you know, from the center by Wickham. We'd take people all around the country, you know, to come in. If I was playing a gig in London, you know, they'd all pile in and come up. And so, and it felt like, you know, we really were doing this together. So when I was saying, you know, this is something to all of my friends, I felt that they were with me, not just because of the music, but because of what I was saying in the music. They take the challenge to their heart. So it's like they're going along with the philosophy of the song as well. So it was a close bond, and it was all, you know, I was playing like sometimes three or four gigs a week and then working during the day in factories and odd jobs and stuff. So I was flat out the whole time. But then the gigs were the intense bit, you know, where those bonds were, you know, created with that group of people. And it was so that's where that, you know, sentiment comes from, really.
What's the second time you mentioned about the lyrics and you wanted to give the fans, the listeners, something to hold on to? Do you think at all that had something to do with the fact that you were 28 and you weren't an 18-year-old kid? Because a lot of times 18-year-old kids not going to worry about that.
No, that's true. I mean, I think I was a bit older and philosophy was really, you know, something I'd always been drawn to since a child. So it had to be in there in the music. You know, I mean, challenging preconceived ideas. I mean, I don't think any pop song has ever
said that. No, and I also noticed there's not much of a rhyme scheme going on here. You know, the lines one and three and lines two and four here do not rhyme at all.
No.
You know, but it works. You make it work on how you deliver it vocally.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't bother too much about, as I got older, I was more bothered about rhyming and being a little bit more clever with that. But in those days, it was like, just let the words, you know, as long as the rhythms were working.
Yeah.
You know, as long as the rhythms were working, and, you know, that was fine for me. You know, and saying goodbye to longstanding, I mean, just the idea of challenging preconceived ideas was really important to me, you know. And it's even more important now, you know, that we do challenge these great big tropes that we've been taught since we were kids about everything. You know, we give them a bit of a forensic analysis and go, actually, I don't think this works. I mean, it doesn't work for me. And so let's evolve this, you know, evolve these ideas so we can, you know, we can get on with each other better. That's the primary thing, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. Do you recall if these vocals were doubled in the verse? Man, the vocal treatment, the delay on it is yeah. really, really cool. But I think I hear a double in there. It's pretty locked, though.
Well, we did. I mean, Rupert had this thing that I was only allowed to do 4 takes. Right. So he would get me vibed up, and you have to remember, I'd never done vocals in the studio before.
Yeah.
So he just wanted to capture the energy. He didn't want it to be a perfected thing or an over
sterile.
Yeah. So you lose that energy. So only 4 takes, and then he would, out of those 4 takes, anything that doubled up, he would probably use it. Right. If mm-hmm. anything doubled nicely, he would use it. And then Steve used, I think, you know, I mean, Steve's amazing with the vocal exciters and
right.
And he's really fantastic with, you know, with delays. I mean, I remember it was a 414 that I used. So that's not a normal mic really to use for vocals.
Right. Yeah.
But Rupert wanted that kind of quite toppy sound, you know, on the mm-hmm. so yeah, so we used that kind of suited my voice, but yeah,
it sounds awesome. I mean, do you still think it sounds great 40 years later, you know, because I know that's so difficult as a performer. I listen to stuff from my younger years, like you know, certain things are okay, but to me, I just, here we are 40 years on, and I think the vocal sounds fabulous.
I'm a complete nerd about vocal tuning and timing. I'm mm-hmm. just obsessed with it. And so when I listen now, I think, oh, there's a couple of notes. But you know, in general, I'm 4 takes and I got it
that's incredible,
reasonably good. You know, I think, well, that's not bad. That,
yeah, and there's no tuning or anything here. It didn't exist then.
You know, when I was doing the one man show, it was just as punk was, you know, maybe coming to the end of its sort of heyday, I was singing very much in a punk way. Honestly, people wouldn't believe this, but I would be singing with a sort of East End accent, and I would be not worried about tuning. I'd be shouting a lot and having a real attitude with the vocal. So a bit, you know, being in tune all the time wasn't... I wasn't part of thinking.
not at all. Well, the second half of verse 1 here, a snare drum comes in with some other instrumentation, and a cool little organ lick comes in after each of the 4 lines here in the second half of verse 1, and then we get into chorus 1. Don't cry. Don't crack up, bend your brain, see both sides, throw off your mental chains. And when I'm reading over these lyrics, I'm thinking, I could see the A&R guy, the label guy going, yeah, we got to call this song Mental Chains, mate. We got to call it Mental Change. You're like, no, it's a new song.
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever recall them trying to persuade me to change it. Maybe I just selectively didn't remember that, but...
My record label drove us nuts with that kind of stuff. I mean, here we are trying to be artists. We're like, no, the title has to be this. We're like, well, that isn't even in the lyrics anywhere. Like, I know, but we're the artist, you're the label, deal with it. And they didn't like that very much.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true. And I can see their point, because they mm-hmm. want you to have a hit with this, and they want, you know, they want like something that gets people to remember the song.
Right after Mental Change, you get what I believe is just, it's a definitive hook of the song. Upon re-listening to this, Howard, and I've heard the song, I don't know how many hundreds of times over the years, it reminded me a little bit of that Blur song, Song Number 2. That's another song, just Song Number 2, that woo-hoo, that thing.
Oh, yeah, you know, this, right, yeah.
Yeah, this is a hook, this ooh-ooh-ooh that happens after every time you say Mental Chains. It's great.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, it's the function of it for me was like the joy of, you know, like, okay, we're going to bend our brains, see both sides and throw off our mental chains. But that is a joyful thing to do. It is not a pain, you know, that's right. A great thing to do. And like, yeah, let's do it sort of thing. And it's great hearing audiences do that now. I just love that, hearing them sing it back to me.
Hey everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more with Howard Jones coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Doctor says you're cured, but you still feel the pain.
And now, back to the show.
Chorus one here, a really cool new bass synth part comes in. It is funky. It is so good. It changes the whole feel. Another synth keyboard type sound comes in as well, along with these 16th note shakers. Then during the last line, we get those great 80s sounding drum machine tom hits to take us into what I'm calling the post-chorus one interlude. And this... What would you call it, Howard? What would you call this part?
I just call it the riff.
The riff. Okay. This is the riff after chorus one, which I'm choosing to call
it. I like your description better. I like your description.
I'm calling this the post-chorus one interlude. It's 8 bars. This beep, okay? It's not the triangle sound. There's a beep on every one. Beep, 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 beep. And it gives this urgency, and it's so great for a dance song, that four and a floor like pulse.
Yeah.
You recall what that is?
I'm missing this bit. I can't think where that came from. I can do some investigation.
That's fine. Well, I promise you it's there. And then after these 8 bars, we immediately come back to chorus two.
Don't crack up, bend your brain, see both sides, throw off your mental chains. Ooh, ooh,
ooh. And that's kind of a dance trick. A lot of the dance music, I should say, a lot of the pop hits, some of the disco bands, I know that Kool and the Gang would do this. They'd have an instrumental part and they'd come right back to the hook. And was that important to you to come back to that? Do you remember? Was it always like that on the demo?
Well, you know, I mean, I really do think that I have to, you know, hats off to Rupert for this, because he was just brilliant with structure. And he, in fact, taught me so much on that record about how to make it interesting for people, because we're, you know, like unexpected things, you know, because you're dealing with pop music songs structure, you know, it's a classic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone kind of knows and expects things to happen. But if you just throw some curves at people, it just gives you a little bit of a thrill. So that's what Rupert was always trying to get with, you know, working with me with those tracks. So I would have probably had, you know, the riff bit, you know, probably the full thing going from C to A minor and back, you know, each time, which I probably
right. Lived.
But he said, no, you know, let's just feed it through bit by bit, let it evolve, and you know, and don't give people everything on the, you know, first time.
excuse my confusion, but I know Colin Thurston, he actually recorded, I guess, did the first version, but yeah. you keep mentioning Rupert. Did he do some editing on the arrangement after the fact?
Well, I mean, when you listen to Rupert's version, it's got this sort of piano solo bit at the end, which is really great. And I just absolutely love that. It must have been me, though, that you're right. You know, it must have been me that came up with that structure.
That's what I'm thinking. That's why I wanted to kind of clarify that with you, because
because I'm thinking of Rupert's version was so I think it's more sophisticated and it's my favorite actually. But obviously, you can't mess with the fact that this was the big hit. And
well, I was going to say, this is the only one that I know, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Chorus two here, the lyric is the same as chorus one. Was that discussed at all? Like, hey, we need some more information here, or we want to keep it simple.
Coming back to the lyrics again, you know, it just reinforces them.
And back then, too, we didn't have Google to look up lyrics at our disposal or you know.
Yes.
Everything you could pretty much hear, you enunciate very well, but, you know, throw off your mental chains. That's a bit odd of a lyric, you know, and that's why I didn't know if Rupert or Colin or anybody came in and said, you know what, we might want to mess with this line, but it doesn't sound like it, though.
No, that's one thing. I wouldn't have stood for that, to be honest. That's
good for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this is the song. It's got to be like this, and you know, I'm not changing that. You know, it just works for me. You know, I would take advice on many other things, but that, no, that's like, that's got to, this has got to be like this. But I never had to have that fight.
That is great, because again, throw off your mental chains is a little bit of a highbrow lyric when you're making pop music. And as you know, people like to dumb things down, especially record labels. So that's why I asked that. After chorus two, you get that ooh, 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 that hook again. And then we get into a two-bar instrumental reintro that's kind of just sits there. It's not as busy. It doesn't have as much going on as that post-chorus interlude. And then we go into what I'm calling verse two. I guess you could call it verse three, but verse two, it's just it's a single verse. It's not doubled like at the top. I don't want to be hip and cool. I don't want to play by the rules, not under the thumb of the cynical few or laden down by the doom crew. I love that.
Yeah, I think that's probably my favorite bit. It's like, I'm not doing this to be fashionable or, you know, follow a trend. I want it to be like the original idea of what rock and roll is all about. It's about an alternative way of looking at things, and it's not fitting into a grid that's imposed on you. You know, that's the, you know, I don't want to play by the rules. I want to be challenging those things, you know, not under the thumb of the cynical few. And so I was hearing a lot of music that people were coming up with at the time that was pretty doomy and cynical about the world. So, and there, honestly, there is a place for that. Of course, there is a place for that. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't do that, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to put out a positive message. And I felt that I was very acquainted with cynicism myself. I could see that very clearly in myself.
Well, you're English.
But I'm not gonna put that out in my music. I'm not gonna be reinforcing that side of me.
Well, I think that's why these lyrics reverberate with your fans and why they've stood the test of time. You know, and as you said, they hit the fans because, you know, looking down, you know, you put a double time drum beat and some big buzzsaw guitars here, and these could be punk lyrics. I mean, not under the thumb of the cynical few or laden down by the doom crew. It's like I could see the Damned singing that or something. And you know, there was a fine line between punks and new wavers at that time, as you know.
Yes, there was. Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I think, you know, this idea of I obviously wasn't aiming to be working, you know, in a bank, say, you know, just for I wasn't aiming to be a classical musician, and you know, and I wanted to be in this culture, you know, pop culture, where you could have a little bit more leeway to like say what you really think, you know, without without it being shut down because, oh, that's not the sort of thing that you know you would do in maybe in any other field. So I was thinking, and that's the always has been the function for me of pop music, rock music, alternative, is to give the opposing view, you know, say, hey, hang on a minute, do we have to be like this? Do we have to, you know, act like this? Is there a better way, you know, for people to be enjoying their life more and be happier with it? You know?
Well, there's a couple of really cool things that happen in this second verse here. You know, there's harmonies, you're singing in unison on all four lines, but there's harmonies that stick out. And do you recall doing that? Was it Rupert or Colin or somebody saying, hey, I need you to harmonize, and you weren't actually harmonizing? Because it's not a genuine full harmony. There is some unison there, but it's awesome.
No, I think that, you know, I mean, this is just harmonies that I, because it would have been with Colin that I did this. Yeah, so that would have been me. Coming up, you know, it doesn't harmonize all the way very easily. So just pick out the bits that it's going to work with, and that's what I did. Yeah,
I love that. I love when that happens, when it's like, yeah, you could have put a strict harmony on everything, but it wouldn't have made you feel the way that the vocal that, yeah, you know, you laid down, like the sporadic harmonies here and there, yeah, along with the unison. There's also organ licks that are here, like verse one, along with four hand claps after every line here in verse two, that organ and those hand claps. And the four hand claps in that verse, that's the only time they happen in the song. And I love that too about this track. There's stuff that's floating in and out that never happens again.
Yeah, that the hand clap thing, became a big hook of the song. And people they do that live, you know, they do that bit. The organ was from my Juno 60. It's pretty much one of the presets. I think I might have tweaked it a bit. And it doesn't, you know, it obviously doesn't sound like a Hammond, because that wouldn't have been appropriate.
No, but it does still have that Hammond-esque feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I you know, I own a Hammond now, and with, you know, with a Leslie, and it's always one of my favorite things to play.
Sure.
But, you know, I couldn't take that with me in my little van when I was doing my gigs. So it's almost like a bit of an oddity to have an organ sound in there with all these synths and stuff going on. But it seemed to work. And I think that also tied it in with, you know, the reference to the past and what people would have done with the real Hammond and stuff.
Well, I love that. Immediately after verse two, we get into chorus three. It's the same lyric. We get that ooh 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 hook at the end, and then we come into the second musical interlude. It's a synth solo for 14 bars. The first two bars are just a reintro before the solo. Probably, Howard, my favorite part of the song, because this part of the song to me has influenced so much that came after it in electronica and dance music. I've heard bites off of this section in a number of songs. I love this part. Again, it's 14 bars total. The first two bars are a reintro, and then that urgent beep that I'm talking about, it's on every beat. It comes in your beep, beep, beep. On bar three, the synth hook is panned left, bar four to the right, bar five to the left, bar six to the right. On bar seven, we modulate a whole step down. It's panned off to the left, on bar eight to the right, bar nine to the left, 10 to the right. On bar 11, we modulate back up a step to where it originally was. Bar 12 is panned off to the right, 13 left, 14 right, into chorus four. And that ping-ponging, that stereo mixing, it's killer.
I've just realized something when you were saying all that. The way I see the song in terms of naming the sections, it's got the verses, but the chorus is actually an instrumental chorus. It's the tune. Da-da-da-da-da-da is the chorus. And then Don't Crack Up, Bend Your Brain, See Both Sides, that's the bridge. So that takes you up to the, you know, the tonic again, you know, back to C with the chorus. Because I just didn't think, you know, I didn't think in a particularly conventional way about how song structure should be. That's why it turned out like that.
Oh, and that's what I just love so much about this. It was your first single, and you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants, but in some amazing way, all the stars lined up and you got this beautiful hit, this beautiful pop song out of it. It's awesome. Out of this musical bridge, I guess, basically, you said the chorus part. We're coming into what I'm calling chorus four. Don't crack up, bend your brain, see both sides, throw off your mental chains. And we get the ooh, ooh, ooh again, that what I'm calling a major hook in this song, into another two-bar reintro. And I'm calling this is like the setup for verse three, which is our second double verse in the song. Again, this is crazy. You went double verse at the top, single verse, and now you're at a double verse again. To your recollection, was that like the demo? Was it written like that?
Yeah, it was. And I it's just the way the song evolved for me live. And you never quite know what's coming next, do you? That's the thing. I think that's exciting. I mean, I guess people don't really do that now.
Well, they don't. And I guess you had woodshopped this enough. You were out at the clubs. You had these pockets of fans that were just, this song was resonating with them. Why would you go cut it differently in the studio if it's working live?
Exactly. It was working live. And I remember something else. You know, the Simmons fills. Doom, 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 doom.
Yes.
That, so that comes from, because I didn't have Simmons drums in my one-man rig, but I did a radio thing for Radio 1 BBC where before I got signed, and I don't know why, but I thought it turned out to be a good idea to get a drummer in to play with me, and he had a complete Simmons kit, which was like the thing of the day, you know, like, you know.
Oh yeah.
And he, you know, he sort of added to my drum machine stuff and things, and I think it may be my favorite version, that live version that we did on Radio 1, and with the Simmons. And so that's where the Simmons got, you know, imported into the recording then, because I liked it so much. And then I got my own Simmons modules then after that, and I used a Simmons sequencer, it was called, as well. So that's how I used to run it live.
You didn't hear that for so long. It was kind of like a four-letter word in the 90s, early 2000s. And I'm telling you, I'm hearing on recordings now, and it just makes me smile. Yeah. I'm hearing those sounds again. It's just like, it's so cool. So out of this two-bar reintro, we're into verse three, which Verse 3 is a double verse like verse 1, and it's the same exact lyric. At this point, did anybody, yourself, question, maybe we should add something else here, or why mess with it?
No rational thought was evolved in making this record.
And that's the brilliance, and that's the beauty of it, which, to your point, you know, hearing this verse again, you know, the same exact lyrics, it makes it almost like a chorus, you know? People can really, really latch onto it.
Yeah, it's like a breakdown verse, isn't it? Breakdown verse, double verse.
Right. Well, the first half is. It's all the same instrumentation, but we go to just kick drum and a new hand clap pattern that happens here. And halfway through, we don't get a reintro like between verse one. We get that two-measure instrumental break. The second half of the verse just comes in here. When you get the whoa-oh, though, halfway through, we get those Simmons drums you're talking about, those fills come in there. And then on the second half, the snare drum is back in. Keys are here after every line, as well as that new hand clap after every line. And then immediately after that, we go into what I'm calling the fifth chorus. It's the fifth time you've heard, "Don't crack up, bend your brain, see both sides, throw off your mental chains," with that ooh, ooh, ooh. And then the ending is the musical interlude again as an outro, which is killer. Again, you get that beeping, and this is probably driving you crazy. You're probably wondering what I'm talking about.
I think I've realized what it is now. It's the Juno 60 doing an arpeggio that's hooked up to the drum machine. So and you're hearing the top note of it that's coming.
Oh, okay.
It's actually an arpeggio that's bubbling underneath as well, but there's I think that's what it is anyway.
Do you know that one thing to me, yeah, is so integral to this song?
Yeah.
Without that little thing, that I'll say it again, it gives it an urgency.
It gives an urgency.
And for, yeah, when you're in the clubs and the drinks are flowing and the smoke's coming out and the music's pumping and you hear that, yeah, beeping that I'm calling,
yeah,
it's awesome.
I mean, and that comes back to the limitations of my one man, you know, electronic band, because there was an 808 drum machine that was then sending a trigger to a 12 note Pro One synthesizer. So, which I had to program in before each show. So I only had 12 notes to play with it. So da 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 da. You know, that had to have a short pattern to cycle round, and then also the drum machine would send a trigger to the Juno 60 that I could slap into arpeggio mode to give that buzz that you're talking, you know, that extra drive. A huge amount of this was due to the limitations of the gear that I had at the time. I'll be playing the bass with my left hand, and that main riff that I call the chorus was played with my right hand, and that whilst I'm playing the bass with my left hand. So it was all within, all the answers really in a way come from that rig.
That is so cool. And I'm telling you, I try to keep this show as best as I can in layman's terms for the listeners. Yeah. I could talk to you about this stuff for days. This kind of nerdy stuff just fascinates me. And, you know, I beyond thanking a guest for coming on this show, from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you for pioneering a lot of what we hear today in electronic music. You really did a lot of groundwork.
Well, you know, I mean, I did have to take a lot of flack for it, which was a bit painful, really. And I think people have taken on board a lot of it, and they've run with it. You know, I mean, I'm really great friends with Brian, you know, BT, who I collaborated with on songs, and to him, for me, he's like the person who's, you know, taking the electronic field, you know, into another era as well. And the first show he saw was me playing in New Jersey, you know, with my one man rig, and it sort of blew his mind there and inspired him. You know, I'm sure I wasn't the only inspiration, but one of the inspirations was to really get into electronic music and then, you know, take it further, which he's done. And then other people listen to that and they take it on further. It's fantastic to see that process go on.
That is awesome. Well, this last outro part here, again, it's two bars kind of by itself, then it's eight more bars of that synth hook panned left and right. It's going back and forth. Whereas before on the first musical interlude, it modulates on bar 11. We don't modulate till bar 14 here, and then it goes back up after a couple bars as we fade out the track. And I can't stress enough to the listeners at home, I know what you went through to put this together back then. Mm. It's remarkable what you created. Congratulations on 40 years.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, thank you so much. I'm so impressed with your analysis of the song.
Thank you.
I'm super impressed with that. And thanks. Thanks ever so much.
No problem. And before we break, is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with? What you have coming up? Any tours? What's going on?
It's the 40th anniversary, as we were saying, of the release of New Song on August 19th. And so I'm putting a tour really to celebrate that, you know, 40 years. Who would have thought that I'd still be out there doing it and loving it as much as I do? And so hope to see people out there on the road, you know, and let's throw off our mental chains together.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today.
Okay, Chris, thank you, mate. You're great.
Hey everybody, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Howard Jones as much as I did. But don't go anywhere, we got the rap segment coming up where Chris and I will talk all about this episode and how awesome Howard Jones is after a few words from our sponsors.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we celebrate and occasionally have a laugh about those bands and artists that had one song that most people remember. Although many musicians may reject the term one-hit wonder, we beg to differ with their aversion to it, because wouldn't we all love to have a beloved hit song? On One Hit Thunder, we're joined by interesting guests from the world of music and comedy to dive into one artist each week. Our back catalog runs deep with episodes about everyone from Wild Cherry to Snow to Tag Team to Harvey Danger, and a new episode comes out every Wednesday. Subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your podcasts and join in on the fun.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Mercy Union, a post-hardcore band that features four touring vets who found themselves stumbling over something exciting in a basement in Jersey City. That first meeting would lead to their debut LP, The Quarry, and their most recent release is called White Tiger. Here's a snippet of their song, 1998.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
Well, Howard was awesome, man. That was so cool. I felt like he had a lot of fun, and I had a lot of fun listening and watching that happen today. That was awesome.
It was, and in his recall, again, this is, you know, 40 years since the song's been released, probably longer since he wrote it, and he, you know, there was a couple things that he had to think about, but his recall was really impressive.
I'm glad that Howard is such a positive guy and such a joy to talk to, because right off the bat, Chris, when you said it, even I was kind of over here, I was kind of like, ooh, I don't know if that's the right word to use with a guy who's so involved in electronic music. But when you said real instruments,
yes,
and then but he corrected you, but in the nicest way ever. He's like, well, I think what you mean is conventional instruments, because who's to say what's real and what's not? Just because something's synth or, you know, electronic, that doesn't make it any less real.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a definitely a poor choice of words, and he's right. I think his terminology was better. Really, what I was getting at, though, and we touched on it a couple of times, Chris, was the backlash that guys like him were getting back then, people calling it not real instruments. Oh, they're making music with computers. We still hear it today, and it's just, it's laughable that 40 years on, we're still talking about that.
Yeah, I don't care what you use to make your music, you still have to make the music.
Yeah.
And that music still has to make you feel something. So I don't care if you're banging on a rock with a stick. If you write a great melody and lyrics that move me, who's to say that that's not an instrument? You know, that's as real as anything else.
Right. And speaking of what you just said, speaking of banging on stuff with a stick and recording it, you know, these guys were making their own sounds. He was talking about his engineer, how he had this cymbal thing and they kind of, you know, ran it through the machine, reversed it. And that's the fluttering noise that I was talking about. And, you know, they were pioneering all this stuff.
Right. Hey, I thought it was really crazy. I never knew that Queen, I don't know what album it was, but the Queen put in their liner notes that no synths were used on this album, as if synths were some sort of bad word or something, because that seems crazy. It seems like Queen, haven't I heard electronic elements in Queen songs before?
Maybe
after that?
You know, Queen and ELO were some of the front runners of bands that were, you know, playing to tape back in the 70s, you know, because the whole middle part of Bohemian Rhapsody, I mean, when they used to play that live, they would pump that through the speakers. You can't recreate that with four
right.
guys on stage. So I always thought that was kind of odd that they put that in their liner notes.
Who are they to talk shit on synths if you're literally just playing it through the speakers? I mean, I love Queen. I found that surprising. I thought they would always be on the cutting edge of anything when it came to music.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
I bet you they look back on that and they're like, that wasn't the greatest. Like, I kind of remember Rage Against the Machine kind of being like that too. We don't use, you know, everything you hear is just what you hear. And I think that's cool to a certain extent, but it doesn't take away from someone else for doing it.
Sure.
I mean, I guess if someone was, you know, maybe in the future, if AI is writing songs or something, we can talk shit on that. But
well, they kind of
don't know.
I think they already are. But I'll tell you something that really impressed me. You know, you hear a lot of the dance tracks that came out around this time, the new wave stuff, and a lot of it was just kind of teeny bopper fluff. But Howard is really adamant about the lyrical message that he wanted to get across. You know, he was very protective of his lyrics, and with good reason. He has a lot to say here. It's positive, but it's almost got like a little punk to it too, which, like I said, those crowds back then, there was definitely a blurred line between the punks and the new wavers.
I mean, I related to so many things, Chris, that I know you'll relate to too. He's talking about how his fans were so important. His core group of fans were so important that in his first single, this is basically a song to them, a song with them, you know? And in punk rock coming up, that's exactly how we had to come up is to feel like you're one with your fans. You know, I think that's really, really cool. And I could also really relate to wanting to express optimism in your music.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's been something that's always been really important to me. But imagine at this time, I think maybe you, made a reference to this. You do have, think of, in even in the new wave movement, think of some of the Joy Division and stuff. And even, you know, to a certain extent, like the Smiths and the Cure and bands like that, where I love those bands, but to a certain extent, there's a little bit of pessimism in the lyrics and stuff, right? This was kind of the antithesis to that.
It was, and Great Britain during this time was in a horrible recession. A lot of the lyrics from the punks and the new wavers, some of the stuff you're talking about, the Cure, yeah, it was melancholy. It was disenfranchised youth. It was all those things. But I just love it. I love that we started out talking about the backlash and some of those things, and here he is in the first verse saying, "I've been waiting for so long to come here now and sing this song to you, the fans." Then he's saying, "But don't be fooled by what you see." Yeah, it's just one guy with some keyboards up here, but I'm the real deal. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. It's kind of like his it's his first song, and it's kind of like, here I am, here's what I do. That is the theme of his first song.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, Chris, we've talked about this before, it's so cool to be able to have that live test of your song before you even record it, to see how the audience responds to it. You know, we don't really have that luxury. Maybe when we're first starting our band, before we record our first album, yes, we've been out playing shows, we see how the audience responds. Since then, not at all. Usually, no. You're not, maybe you'll play a new song every once in a while that you haven't recorded yet, but usually, even if you put a new song in your set, it's something you've already recorded.
Yeah, and in this instance, he was playing the song for so long, he knew it was a hit among these diehards, these loyal fans that were coming out to see him. It was like, when they went to record it, they weren't going to mess with the arrangement of the lyric, which I thought was brilliant.
I mean, I just thought he was all around awesome. I loved how much he seemed to be having a good time with this. I told you that as soon as we got off. A lot of laughs. I was laughing a lot through this, just seeing his reaction. Dude, I love seeing people's reaction when they first realize, like, oh, he's getting into the weeds here on this song. This isn't like some interview I've done a million times. He's talking to me about the beeps and little, drum machine specifics of the song. And I think, you know, at least it seemed to me like he really enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah. And in this instance, those little beeps and those little bells and whistles and those woo-oo-oos, they all add up to the sum of the hit of what the song is. They're all integral in this track. And I'll tell you something else that's integral to our listener base, Chris, is if they are not part of our supporting cast, they should be. You want to tell them where they can get signed up for that?
Yeah, you could just head to chrisdemakes.com and you'll get a bonus episode every single week. It's a podcast that we make called The After Party. Apparently, people really like it because a lot of people talk to me about it. And you also support the podcast you love for a few bucks a month for the cost of buying Chris and I a cup of coffee, because you enjoy the podcast and we supply you with entertainment and knowledge and a few laughs. You can support the podcast. It's easy as that. I kind of lost my train of thought. Doesn't really matter. That's the point. ChrisDemakes.com.
That's right. ChrisDemakes.com. Go there and subscribe. We'd love to have you. We also love to have you in our Facebook group, the Chris Makes a Podcast Facebook group. Go join, be a part of our community over there. Over, I think it's like 4,600 people we got in that group now, Chris. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's great. It's a lot of music fans, and everybody, 99.9% of the people in there are just people that love music, want to talk about music. It's a very positive place. Once in a while, I had to kick someone out because they were being very negative in there. I'm like, you gotta go.
Yeah,
this,
we don't.
This isn't a place for fighting. Sorry, buddy, you gotta go.
Not at all. We've built a wonderful community over there. We absolutely love it. So yeah, and give me a follow on Instagram if you can, at less than Chris D. Want to thank this week's guest. He was absolutely awesome, Howard Jones, for sitting in with us, and we'll see you next week.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.